This is talking with Gordon Pettengill on 31 August 76 at Grenoble. Now, I haven't done too much in radar astronomy, and I'm not a radar astronomer myself, so I'm not as up on it as the other, so don't assume anything. Now, you did some lunar radar to begin with, right?
Yes, my first involvement in radar astronomy was in about 1957, 1958. When the large Millstone radar came into existence. This was just at the time when the first Sputnik went up.
Ah, yes.
And of course, that provided a convenient target, which we were interested in observing to test it out. And of course, it was a simple matter also to direct it at the moon. We used to use the moon as a calibration target at times.
I see.
That, of course, elicited interest in the intrinsic properties of the moon. There'd been some lunar work a few years previously, by Dr. John Evans at the Jodrell Bank Observatory. There'd been some work by Trexler as well, which at that time was classified, which was subsequently declassified when it became clear that Evans had found the same findings and published them.
Right.
But
was there any other work before then? Can you just sort of enumerate?
Well, Yapley was working in that time.
Right.
His interest was primarily in using very short pulses and getting orbital measurements of the moon. Both Trexler and Evans' interest was in the intrinsic scattering properties of the surface, and as you may remember, they found, to them at the time, the rather surprising fact that the moon was a much more nearly specular reflector at radio wavelengths than it was obviously at optical wavelengths.
Yeah.
This stimulated a lot of theoretical interest in describing the surface properties that would yield the observed data. And as the signal strengths improved, Millstone radar offered considerably more echo strength than the earlier work had because it had a larger aperture and a higher power transmitter.
Well, it didn't have a larger aperture than Jodrell.
Yes, the work at Jodrell was done with a very small phased array.
Oh, it wasn't
the large.
The
250-foot Mark I came in 58. All of Evans' work was done in 56 using a dipole array, and the echo strengths were very much weaker, believe me.
Right.
In any event, we began in 1958, or I began, I should say, became interested in the possibilities of doing frequency analysis. And about 1959, there was a Dr. Green, Paul E. Green, who had done some work in connection with modulation techniques to propagate through the ionosphere. Some of these techniques led him to investigate the scattering properties of the moon, and he made some suggestions, which I followed up experimentally, to begin to map the surfaces of a rigid rotating body such as the moon using simultaneous resolution of the echo in frequency and in time plane.
I see. Was this principle pretty obvious to anyone, but was the detail working out that...
Well, it's hard to say what obvious means. Everything's obvious once you've stated it.
Yeah.
I don't think it was all that obvious. There was also a group at Stanford that was getting interested at that time. Rolf Dice, Ray Liederbrand, and Alan Peterson.
Although,
you'll find two articles in the January 1960 IEEE proceedings, one by myself and one by the Stanford group, both describing the idea, only I had made the measurements, they were only postulating it. So in that sense, perhaps I skipped them a little bit.
But it's also true that the moon's effective rotation rate is incredibly small. So
it's very
small.
It
wouldn't
low,
come
right.
to you like you, when you see a spinning Mars or something.
Well, we do the same thing on Mars.
Oh, I know, but what I'm saying is that the idea might not be so apparent.
It's,
as it would be
there are some technical problems in a rapidly spinning object, you're right. But of course, Venus is even slower than comparable.
Yeah, that's true. Let me just ask, was your training as an electrical engineer?
No, my training was as a physicist with the graduate emphasis in nuclear physics.
Oh, I see. So well, how'd you get into this?
Well, I had been a radio amateur as a boy and had my face rubbed in electrical engineering at MIT because even though I was taking physics, particularly in those days, they considered a physics education incomplete if you didn't have a solid electrical engineering exposure. So I had all of the power labs and all the rest of it as well.
Right.
So I felt myself fairly well grounded in electrical engineering. And it was more a matter of a feeling at the time that I received my graduate degree, which was 1954, that the opportunities in nuclear physics were somewhat more limited than those in radio physics. Radio physics was a rapidly growing field, and while nuclear physics was too, it had a very large number of people in it. I preferred to be a small fish in a small pond than a small fish in a large pond. So I took advantage of an offer to come back from California to Lincoln Laboratory.
I see. You had been out there doing nuclear physics.
That's correct. At the radiation laboratory.
The Millstone radar, was that built in response to Sputnik or just happened to come at the same time?
That was built as a test bed for some large antenna, large transmitter techniques, probably looking toward the detection of ballistic missiles.
And so
the response to Sputnik was entirely accidental.
I see.
It was the right instrument in the right place at the right time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I have here your three publications before 1960. Apparently you did some lunar mapping, actually, 440 megahertz.
That's the January 1960 IEEE.
Right.
Yes.
Proceedings of the IR. And this diffuse scattering component is mentioned.
Yeah.
Was that a surprise?
Well, I don't know what you mean by surprise. Yes, in a sense, we come full circle, because the initial discovery by the Jodrell Bank group under John Evans and I.C. Brown, as well as Trexler's group, was that the moon was so secular, relatively speaking, much more so than it appeared optically. But of course, the possibility that it also had a diffuse component, albeit at a much lower level, was initially overlooked. And that was discovered.
That's what you picked up.
Yes.
It wasn't because you were at a different frequency or something.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
When you say a surprise, it's hard to say what you mean by surprise. Yeah.
So what sort of level, what sort of power?
We had signal to noise to go down 30 or 40 decibels already. So.
What was the? This was all Air Force sponsored, right?
At that
the
time,
Millstone
it was
radar,
all Air Force sponsored.
Right. And was there interest in supporting lunar radar work simply to develop techniques?
In those days, it was considered very worthy of support to do any sort of basic research. Those were the days before the Mansfield Amendment,
right,
when all of the armed services had tremendous support of basic research throughout.
Okay.
So this was just an example.
So this work was not classified in any sense
that
you were doing, right?
No.
Yeah. It was just like the radio astronomy done at NRL or something like this.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Okay, well, it seems the next step, at least in your own personal history here, is the attempt on Venus.
That's right.
Can you tell me about how that came about?
Well, that came about in 1958. The attempt was made. We had certainly a very marginal tool in those days. We had a transmitter that had never come up to more than 20% of its design spec. It was designed for 2.5 megawatts of peak power, and we had never coaxed at that time, 58, more than a 500 kilowatts output.
I see.
We did have a very early and experimental laser, however, which gave a very low system temperature, about 140 degrees, give or take, which in those days was considered very good.
Right.
I know, but
right.
It was then.
And what frequency were you at?
440. So the group with Paul Green again, and Robert Price, myself, and a few others, Michael Ash and Tom Goblick, put together a very hasty, I have to say hasty, because it was decided to do it only a quarter of a month or so prior to the close approach of Venus in 1958. And it was hoped that perhaps Venus would be particularly reflective. We knew we had no chance of seeing it if it were as reflective as the moon. We didn't know much about it. We took a chance, and we didn't, in fact, see it, although there was a very weak echo which gave some of the indications of being there, and we published that as a possibility. We all recognized it.
This is the 59 article in Science.
That's right.
Which says that 2 out of 4 attempts yielded some positive statistical evidence.
That's right.
That was the wording.
But in retrospect, it cannot have been real. There's no explanation.
Yeah.
But it was a very weak echo. It was only 3 or 4 standard deviations.
But what you're implying is that even at that time, the whole team.
Well, some of us were more convinced than others.
Right.
I confess I was. I would not have published it had I not had their pressure to do so.
Yeah.
Now, the next year we tried again in 59 with a slightly better system. Still couldn't find an echo. And in 1961, we tried with the system now full up. We had the full power. And also, if you recall, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory group under Dick Goldstein made a try. It was also a try at a facility down in Morristown, Pennsylvania.
Oh. Who runs that?
That was an RCA experimental facility. And the Russians also made an attempt to use it, at that time, an unspecified facility under Kotelnikov.
And where was this facility?
Well, we subsequently learned many years later that it was in the Crimea. At that time, they weren't saying.
Well, the 25-meter dish that's used for radio astronomy
right,
also?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No. This was a prototype of their deep space net.
It's
not the same one used for radio astronomy. But again, we didn't find that out until 5 years later.
Yeah. But what happened in 1960?
61.
60. You skipped over.
50? No, there was none in 60.
Well, there was no...
There's an occurrence every 19 months. There was one in 59, and then none in 60, and then there was one in April of 61. Okay? November 59 to April 61.
Right.
The 18 months, 18 and a half. The JPL group announced success, and about 5 days later, we also did. And we realized then that the value of the astronomical unit, which we had deduced from the 1958 results, was wrong, and therefore that result was an error. We admitted so when we wrote up the 1961 result. Using the 61 result, we were able to do a much more powerful analysis of the 59 data, which we had on tapes.
You knew where to look.
We knew where to look.
Right.
And we knew how to connect it up coherently to build up signal noise. It would have been an impossible job to search the tremendous range of values of the AU which were possible at that time. So we couldn't have done it without the later measurement. But this established a pre-discovery value of 59, which is also a print that's published.
Yeah, I see.
Now, let's see, there was an interesting anecdote here. The Russians published a value in 61 based on our findings of 58, which were erroneous.
Oh, yes.
And they were trapped because the way they took their data permitted any of a number of values to be correct. And they chose that value closest to the one we published in 58. When we took data in 61, the JPL as well, we took enough measurements that we were unambiguous. We knew what the correct value was. And then when the Russians learned of that, they of course were able to select the correct value out of their results. So it was an interesting vestigial
they couldn't go wrong.
Now,
I'm rather interested.
What, 61 is the beginning of the real planetary.
Right. What was really your interest in these 3 years before the detection? If you had to put forth really why you were doing it, was it just before
61?
Yeah, the 3 years before 61, was it just for the sheer joy of getting that echo back, or
were
you really interested in the AU value?
Yes, we were interested in the AU value. We were interested in the surface properties of the targets we were looking at. We were interested in the interplanetary medium. As I told you, I reverted to an interest in radio physics, which encompassed quite a number of physics, aspects of physics.
Now, but to get an interest in the AU, it would seem like you would have to do a bit of reading up on celestial mechanics and get someone in the group.
We had Robert Price, who was the theoretician at that time. I'm trying to remember when Dr. Shapiro was drawn in. It must have been about that time, although he was not one of the original investigators. He must have come aboard about that time, nevertheless. He began to explore the possible uses of radar from a celestial mechanics and a cosmological, that is, gravitational theory test, when he came up with the fourth test, so-called.
This was when he came up with that?
That was later. I think that must have been around 1964.
Yeah. Was it clear, even in 58 or 59, that you could make a tremendous improvement on the value of the AU?
We all realized that three orders of magnitude would happen with the first measure.
And that's what it ended up being when you in 61.
Well, 61, we went from about a part 10 to the 3 to, our measurements were the order of a millisecond accuracy at the time of 61. AU is of the order of 1,000 seconds, so that's about a part 10 to the 6th. We went from a part 10 to the 3, which was the optical, if you took a realistic assessment of the errors, it would be part 10 to the 3. There are plots in the literature showing a scatter of all the values, and they encompass about a part 10 to the 3.
Right.
We went immediately to a part 10 to the 6th.
And
at the moment, we stand at a part 10 to the 10th. There are a few parts in 10 to the 10th. But that second 5 orders of magnitude took a lot of effort.
Did the radar value overlap in this?
It was right
in the middle of
not the middle, but comfortably within the brackets.
Yeah, so it was only later when there came this discrepancy between the radar value and the mean optical value. Or am I got something wrong?
As I said, if you took a realistic assessment of the errors, many of the people at that time were giving unrealistic assessments of their errors by at least an order of magnitude.
I see. And in that case, can you say specifically what methods were being overestimated as to their reliability?
Well, there were two basic methods. One was to the so-called dynamical method, which involved watching a minor planet in Eros, was the usual choice, passing close to the Earth, and then of course moving on around the Sun, and by essentially using the equations of motion, which are well understood, one can deduce the distance from the dynamical considerations. Right. The other possibility is to actually do triangulation. I'd call that a geometric approach, where you have something close enough to Earth that a diameter of the Earth baseline can be used to see parallax, mm-hmm. and that parallax in turn can be bootstrapped up to where it's a measure of the distance from the Sun through the intermediation of a third body also. Mm-hmm. But the approach is conceptually very different. And I can't answer why they were underestimating their errors. They must have been assuming some quantity to be better known than it was.
Now, when you say a realistic assessment, someone coming in from the outside, just simply comparing what one
I would say a realistic
person had relative to another.
Assessment in the sense that if you took all of the measurements made by reasonably good observers, you had a spread of a part
right.
10 to the 3.
Right.
Any given measurement might have error bars which were a part 10 to the 4.
Right.
But if you took the whole value together and...
This, of course, is not the only time that this sort
of
thing has happened.
Yeah. Each individual tended to underestimate his error point. By taking the scatter and performing an experiment, you might say, of the post-fit residuals, you could see that, in fact, the errors had to be larger. Somebody wasn't right.
Yeah. Now, on this Venus detection, I gather there must have been sort of a great sense of competition.
There was. By 1961. There wasn't in 58. Then, but by 61, you see they had improved the Goldstone tracking facilities, the JPL Deep Space Lab, enough so that it was possible to see it. Jodrell Bank also made a measurement, and we mentioned that. We were in the 1961 measurements.
And the detection?
Yes.
I see.
It just seemed as though, by accident or for whatever, there happened to be a lot of sufficiently large antennas suddenly on the scene with adequate transmitters to conceive of seeing Venus.
Right. Was there any thought that maybe Mars might actually give a bigger signal than Venus? I mean, it's obviously further away, but that its reflective properties might be...
Well, one was trying anything that seemed impossible.
Yeah. And I mean, so were you trying Mars in this period?
Mars was tried later. Mercury was tried, if I recall correctly, before Mars. I'm trying to remember when the first Mars attempts were made. I think the Russians made attempts on them, and I think they reported positive results, but I don't remember clearly at the moment. It was certainly much later than your time period.
Yeah.
All of this was happening 62, 63,
but
64.
But I'm wondering if someone might have said, well, it looks like Mars is a worse bet, but since it's coming around, why don't we give it a try? I mean, around 1960.
No.
No.
You can calculate, no target was expected to be more than unity was reflected.
Yeah, right.
And if you can show that you have no hope even at that, it's
a
waste of time.
And that was the case.
No one talked about it if they did it.
Yeah.
Many people tried it on the assumption it might be 0.51, and they didn't see it. That's certainly.
Were there any special technical difficulties in getting the Venus signal to come up, or was it just simply a matter that you
just a matter of getting the radar parameters and knowing the AU. I mean, happened. Initially, we had to find it.
Right.
Once we know it, we could do tricks
then you can
like
integrate
coherent
like
integration.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I mean, it was just really a matter of power, is all
that's
you're saying.
Right.
And
that's right.
It wasn't really a change in technique or anything like that.
No. The techniques that were laid down in those days are the ones we still use by and large.
Now, did you try to do anything with it besides the AU? I mean,
at that time, we measured the cross section and did the AU.
Yeah.
It was a bare detection.
When was the first time, just from my information, when information on the surface of the planets?
Well, we had information on the surface, but...
From the cross overall, but I mean detailed information.
Well,
we
it
had
was a gradual increase as the systems grew in sensitivity. We could use shorter pulses, and the general approach was to go to that pulse width, which still permitted reliable detection.
I see.
This was gradual.
Yeah.
It went from milliseconds to 100 microseconds to 10 microseconds, and now
I see. So, and would you say it's reasonable to say that was every 2 or 3 years, so it's sort of a logarithmic?
The general rule is that the radar sensitivity increased 5.5 dB per year. And if you plot from 1946 to essentially the present year, you will find that that curve is very well maintained.
I see.
Some ups and downs, but very well maintained.
I see. Is this curve published somewhere? Or are you?
I'm not sure it's been published in the literature itself. It certainly appeared in some reports in there. I'm not sure whether that one here, in a review article. It certainly will be in
the
next.
Could you send me a copy of that? I'd be very interested in it from a historical point of view.
Yes,
showing,
could, but
comparing that with...
I hope I can remember. I'm going to be very busy when I get back.
Well, maybe I can drop you a note.
You could drop me a note.
I'll do that. Now, so you're in 61, you've detected a planet. What's the next step? What more do you want to do?
Two things happen. One is you want to see that planet in more detail, and you want to move on to other objects. You did both.
And this is still all from a scientific point of view, entirely.
Yes. At that point, radar astronomy was as pure as radio astronomy in terms of what we were interested in.
You say at that point, earlier...
Well, it had the, I mean, the impetus for the development of the large facilities was clearly military. General Bank, of course, wasn't. That was radio astronomy. In the U.S. It certainly was. In Russia it certainly was.
And so when was the next significant milestone that was
involved
with your group?
Well, Haystack was the next quantum jump in our group, and that came in 1965, 1966. And that was quite an important step.
What were you able to do before, in addition to the Venus detection before Haystack?
Well, with Haystack, we could follow Venus all the way around the Sun, and not just observe it when it was at inferior conjunction. We could map the Moon to a few kilometers in surface resolution, and did do so.
Was the justification for Haystack primarily radar?
The justification for Haystack is an odd one. It started out as a radome test facility.
I see.
Someone was then able to pry a few million dollars loose on the grounds that, well, here we have this beautiful radome and it's close to a research interest. Shouldn't we put an antenna inside?
Right. It doesn't... Well, that story's a little hard to believe. I mean...
Yes, but that's in fact the proof.
But the antenna must have added a great amount of cost.
There was some pressure to build this antenna for what was then called the Needles Project.
Oh, yes.
And that's why the name Haystack was given it, because it was looking for needles in a haystack. Bad pun, but it's true.
I never realized it. That's where that name came from.
That's where it came from.
Oh, God. But before Haystack came into operation...
We had Millstone.
Right, but I mean, what other steps were there that you did with your group? Was it only a matter of trying to do Venus better?
No, Mercury was in 1962 or 3, and we got the Millstone. Millstone was upgraded. It became a 1200 megahertz facility, which of course improved its sensitivity. That made Mercury available.
Right.
It made for much better measurements of Venus.
Did the AU value that you got for Mercury nicely agree with the
everything
Venus?
Has
I see.
In fact, all of our orbital eruptions now are done simultaneously with all the planets in the act.
I see.
This means square adjustment on all the planets.
Then would you say it's fair to say...
Including optical observations.
I see. Is it fair to say that there have been no great disagreements between different groups in radar astronomy?
There was initially a disagreement between the JPL group and ourselves over the value of the AU, which we stayed the same and they moved down to us. There's no disagreement anymore. It was just a question of their getting their orbital theory in full, all of the terms included.
When did this resolution come about?
Oh, that probably wasn't until about 1961. It took a long time, and it was
all
gradual.
The way from the very beginning detection.
Yes. Well, initially the error bars were so large that one couldn't see it. As soon as we began to get down to 10 to 15 microsecond accuracies, they were grouping around, I forget the exact numbers, but it was about 300 kilometers away in terms of distance.
Nice.
149.5907. Versus, don't quote me on the numbers, but I know it was on the order of 300 kilometers. And it finally closed up. If you look at the review article in the 1965, the volume 3 of the annual review of astronomy and astrophysics.
Right.
We'll see a discussion.
Okay. Now, I'd like to ask as to a part, which community did you feel a part of? Were you talking to astronomers from the very beginning,
yes,
or were you...
Astronomers.
Right from
solar system astronomy.
I see.
And celestial mechanics.
But you were publishing in Proceedings of the IRE.
Well, because it was a radio technique. If you remember, a lot of radio astronomy was in PROC IRE.
Right.
The whole issue devoted to it in 1958,
right,
if you remember.
Right. Oh, yes.
That's why.
Right. So...
And JGR. A lot of my stuff was in the Journal of Geophysical Research.
So...
the lunar world.
So you would say that you were astronomers to the extent that radio astronomers were.
Yes, exactly.
They were becoming accepted
exactly
about that time.
Exactly. IRSI was our floor.
Right. Right. Let's see. I'm interested to ask you if your opinion of whether techniques have been the overriding thing, or has it been a matter that you wanted to do something and you then developed the technique?
I think I can say very clearly that my introduction to it was through the techniques, interested in techniques. This was broadened out. I had a basic training in physics, so it didn't take a great deal to broaden my interest into the solar system physics and the astronomy of it. I quite obviously did not start as an astronomer.
Yeah.
I never had a course in my life in astronomy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I entered this game in 1959 not even being aware of recession.
Yeah. Well, this course had all the radio astronomers.
That's right.
10 years earlier.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. But you also mentioned the possibility of studying interplanetary medium. I'm not aware if radar has really contributed to that.
Oh, yes. It has indeed. Initially, of course, our own ionosphere, which isn't really the medium. But there have been a number of measurements using comps, let's say simultaneous ranging to the moon and simultaneous ranging to Venus at, let's say, 50 megahertz and 400.
Yeah.
And you look for the difference in the group delays.
I see.
Significant. You can actually measure the integrated content. Of course, actually, Evan's work was motivated by the study of the Faraday rotation in the Earth's magnetosphere. That's what motivated him.
I see.
He used the moon as a source of echoes.
Reflector out there,
but then he got interested in the lunar characteristics.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what started him out. He started out in ionosphere, where he is today. Full circle, going back to it.
And these other experiments you mentioned, when did they take place?
Which other?
Going to the moon and being simultaneously at two frequencies.
Well, let's see, those were later. 65 was the Venus experiment. That was Campbell and Grumman doing it.
Hmm.
I don't honestly know the lunar work that well. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I can talk to you more then. Now, what about, we haven't mentioned the rotation periods, which were...
Mercury.
Especially,
what do you mean?
Well, and Venus. That's a bit later, I think.
Well, that, of course, began to surface as soon as we had enough signal strength to see well out to the limbs on these objects. They're quasi-specula, so that the early echoes you get are from a small central spot. But as your sensitivity increases, you see more and more bandwidth. At some point, you begin to infer that full bandwidth of the planet from the behavior. That's essentially what Goldstein did, and he was the first to discover the fact that Venus had a retrograde rotation. So full credit to Dick Goldstein for that. I was the first to discover that Mercury had the 59-day rotation period. I can say there that it wasn't accidental. I actually took those data with the aim of measuring Mercury's rotation, expecting to find 88 days, of course.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you. Had you sort of looked through the literature and everything about Mercury's rotation and Schiaparelli's stuff?
By 1965, I was sophisticated enough in astronomy, as I just indicated through the learning process, to want to verify the rotation of Mercury, and I was fully expecting 88 days. I just couldn't believe it. But, I mean, the first hour's data made it very clear it was not 88 days. Mm. So you do what you always do. You recheck your calculations.
Right. Well, or you
and
recheck the
I
recheck
the calculations
too.
and the data.
Right.
And then I went and borrowed somebody else's program that he'd written for a different purpose and ran a check through that just to see, make sure it wasn't my pencil and paper that was wrong. And it also agreed. Within the end of that day, I mean literally, within 8 hours, I had double-checked that result and knew the answer.
Yeah.
One of those few cases in one's life when something like that happens.
Mm.
Clear cut, right?
Yeah, yeah. now how did the theoretical explanation, which is generally accepted now, come about?
That evolved. Slowly, I guess I have to say. I did not immediately myself realize that it was two-thirds lock. The possibility, of course, came out that Mercury is in a very eccentric orbit. In fact, the rotation of Mercury very well matches its angular rotation near perihelion.
Oh, yes.
We've done that calculation. Right. Actually turns over.
I see.
And so it was clear that...
So the sun goes backwards in the Mercurian sky or something.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are forces acting there to bring it down, and that much was realized fairly early, and that was in the original Discovery article. In Nature.
In 1965.
Right. There's also a companion paper by Gold which carries that even further. The discovery that it was also, as nearly as our accuracy permitted, a two-thirds of the period of 88 was Colombo, Pepe Colombo. And I think that was just a few months later.
Why was that a discovery?
Well, the realization.
Oh, the realization that it was. Yes. Yeah. So you didn't take new data, you just said, look at
that.
That's
right, exactly.
Oh, I see. So that didn't hit you at first.
No, oddly enough, it did not. I have to confess that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe today it would have, but I was still feeling my way into the astronomy at that time.
It's always easy to look back.
Exactly, right.
But you brought up the point about programs, and that's rather different than radio astronomy even then was. There's tremendous dependence on computer programs.
Oh, yes. We were absolutely dependent on computer programs even in 63 and 60. Well, even in 58.
Well, I was going to say, what about 58?
58, absolutely.
What computer were you using then?
We were using an IBM, whatever it was of that time period. My numbers is not as good, but it was 709, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tube machine, obviously, in those days.
Right.
In one of the early computers at Millstone, in fact, was the first solid-state computer that was working, wasn't just a laboratory curiosity, was built at Millstone in 1958, called CG24, for odd reasons. Computer Group 24, I guess, because they developed it. And we did use that from 59 onwards, and that greatly expedited our work. But we were dependent on computers from the beginning.
Can you imagine that it might have been possible to set up some analog integrating device that could pick up Venus in 61?
With the radar sensitivities available in 58, it would not have been possible to have done this analog. It had to be advanced.
Right. What about 61?
In 61 also. Today, of course, we look at the scope, we can see echoes.
Yeah.
But that's because we have such reserve power now.
Right.
It's not a luxury we had then.
Is it a fair statement then to say that planetary radar astronomy really, the computer was a necessity, not just a...
The computer played a tremendous role, in my opinion, in two ways. It enabled the use of radars to do planetary astronomy, and it revitalized the whole field of celestial mechanics by permitting numerical integration, so you didn't have to go to all of these analytical approximations and information theory, which obviously had its limits.
Well, that might have happened without radar astronomy.
Yeah, of course, it would have happened without radar astronomy. The simultaneous appearance in these two fields of the computer enabled these two fields, radar to make the accurate measurements, celestial mechanics to actually use them to the precision that they permitted them to do, would not have been possible without the computer. So you have to say that along with large antennas, high-powered transmitters, the computer played a very central role in all this.
Eager almost astronomers, too. Don't forget them.
Sorry?
Eager almost astronomers. Eager to be astronomers is another vital ingredient.
Yes, that's true.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.